first, so you want to be the president of the United States? You're not alone. A lot of people have grown up with that dream over the years. It's a high-profile job. You'll go down in the history books, and you'll have a lot of power to shape the future of the country. But hold on. With great power comes great responsibility to the people, to the country, and to the Constitution. There's debate out there over the provisions of the Constitution and how they limit the powers of the president. Our next guest has written a user's guide to the Constitution for future presidents of the United States, and for the rest of us, too. Corey Brettschneider is a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, also a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His new book is The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. Corey, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, that's a very specific target audience. What made you want to write this guide? I know it's for the rest of us, too, but what made you want to write this constitutional guide for the hypothetical future president out there?
I've been teaching these topics in constitutional law, for instance, what was the dry topic of whether the president can hire and fire prosecutors, for instance, or special prosecutors for a long time. And then when Trump started to run and to make a series of proposals that were really different than any previous candidate in their lack of knowledge, I'd say, of the Constitution and its hostility, I started to think about a guide to originally Trump's violations of the Constitution. And then I thought, you know, what the country really needs is not a focus just on this moment, but a reflection on what it takes to be president of the United States, and a look at Article 2, which defines the office of president in constitutional terms, in terms of its limits. And it's really a guide, not just, of course, for future presidents, but for the rest of us, for citizens, and how to vote for a president. And I want the next presidential election to be a referendum on the Constitution and the role of the president within that system.
The tricky bit, or one of the tricky bits, is, you know, the Constitution's a pretty short document. People have been reading it in some ways, in different ways, when it comes to the president, going back at least to John Adams, the second president, if not even to George Washington. There are different interpretations, ways of reading it, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I am with Washington, I guess, and against Adams in the book in this sense. Washington's second inaugural address really sets the theme and the thesis of the book. He says there, look, I've just taken the oath of office. But if I violate the Constitution, the oath requires me to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. But if I violate it, I want you, the people assembled before us, and he had just a few members of Congress. It was a very small gathering in Philadelphia. And he said, I want the people assembled here to subject me to criticism and subject me to constitutional punishment. Because me, George Washington, I am not the office. The office is in some sense distinct and above me. And so I use that as sort of a message to the rest of us, to hold a president who violates the Constitution to account. On Adams, he was really, I think, although he thought he was acting within the constitutional system, he really had something much closer to the monarchy in mind, and in particular, his support of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which made it a crime to criticize the president of the United States, but made it legal to criticize the vice president, a member of a different party, Thomas Jefferson. That was really an example of a president who had gone astray in the worst possible way. So I'd say certainly there have been different interpretations. I'm trying to give the best one, and I'm with Washington and against Adams and his regime of censorship. I think that's a good leg to stand on.
Well, fast forward to 2018 now. Looking back at Article 2, what do you see as the most important limits on the power of a modern president that we should be learning when we reread the Constitution?
One thing I talk about is the war power. The Constitution is very clear, and here I don't think scholars really disagree, although presidents disagree. It's Congress that has the power to initiate war and declare war is the language that's used, and the president that's commander-in-chief. So I think we need a new War Powers Act to demand, for instance, that the first strike of nuclear weapons only be ordered by Congress, not by president. I think we also need to fix sometimes the framers really rely relied on a president that would honor the Constitution. And another place I think that we need to fix is to defend independent the special prosecutor from being fired without cause. We need to go back to the old independent counsel rule. So those are two examples, I think, of where we've gone astray.
Let's key in on that War Powers Act before we move on too far from it, because this is not just a Donald Trump issue. A lot of presidents have been stretching that, people have said, and saying, well, yes, there are troops here. They're in harm's way. It's not a war, though, so I can do this as president.
Right. And I'm very critical, for instance, of President Obama's use of drones in Libya, where, you know, even members of his own Office of Legal Counsel said, you know, this is a to initiate war in Libya specifically, you need Congress. And President Obama didn't listen to them. And I think that's just an example where presidents of both parties certainly can go astray. This isn't just a book about Trump. It's also critical of many Democratic presidents as well.
Talking to Corey Brettschneider, author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. And Corey, you write not just about what presidents do, but also about what they say, how they use what came to be called the bully pulpit under Theodore Roosevelt. What should that hypothetical future president bear in mind?
You know, there isn't a lot of court restrictions on what a president can say, but certainly the bully pulpit is one of the most powerful things that a president does. And it was invented by Roosevelt and really turned into a constitutional ideal by Wilson and then expanded again by Trump. In this sense, Wilson really had to rely on the press, right, to get his message across and turn to lobby Congress to pass legislation he wanted. Trump has really revolutionized the bully pulpit because he can speak directly to us through Twitter and possibly through our cell phones, and the press is sort of an afterthought. But with that great power, I think, has to come even more recognition of the limits of the office. And the language of the bully pulpit has to be used to not just not violate the Constitution, not just not speak against it, but to defend it. And Wilson and Trump also have this in common. They both, in their racist rhetoric, in their disparagement, in Trump's example, for instance, saying that there are good people on both sides of in the Charlottesville dispute between Nazis and anti-Nazis. That is like Wilson and his celebration of the Ku Klux Klan. And I think we need to see this as a violation of the Constitution, because presidents are being elected to defend the ideals of the Constitution, including equal protection of law, anti-racism. And so these two examples are really of presidents gone astray.
You mentioned the hiring and firing of a special prosecutor, but you write more generally about the president and his or her administration's ability to fire civil servants. That's an open debate under the Trump administration. It's got a long history in the United States. Can you talk us through how we got where we are today?
Sure. Wilson, again, I think in some ways is the bad guy in this, in that he really didn't like the idea that many executive offices were protected by Congress. And the reason for that historically has been, going back to the 19th century, that Congress has legislation, and part of the job of the executive branch is to carry out that legislation. And so by protecting civil servants and members of the executive branch from firing without cause or without disregard of their basic duties, that's a way of Congress ensuring that the law will be executed and that a president won't act as a lawmaker. But many presidents have attacked that. Wilson is one, and certainly Trump is another and has made that very prominent. And I really call for a restoration of the idea that was recognized really since the 1930s and earlier, that Congress can make laws protecting protecting civil servants with an aim to carrying out the law. And that's nowhere is that more important than when it comes to those who are investigating wrongdoing of a president. If a president isn't above the law, it stands to reason that a special prosecutor has to be able to bring charges and can't be fired because a president wants to protect him or herself. The idea of the oath is that a president has to act for others, not for oneself. And so this is an important place where that informs the need for protection of civil servants and certainly a special prosecutor, an independent prosecutor.
Yeah, and you focus on the oath of the office. What does the president pledge to do when it comes to the Constitution when they take office?
I mean, really, if you look in Article 2, the first few seconds in office are prescribed. The president not only has to take an oath, they're very specific words. When Obama flubbed it at one point, they did it a second time. They take it that seriously. But I think many people hear the oath and they sort of think of it as a ritual. But the actual promise, the oath, is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, not just the country, but to recognize the rule of law and to go beyond the minimum of what's required to really interpret it for one one's self. So that idea of Article 2 stands for the notion of limits on the president and a president's obligation to respect the Constitution, even when, and this is crucial for me, courts don't require it. So maybe courts have not said, for instance, that a president can't torture, but I say that certainly it is incumbent on presidents to recognize that the Eighth Amendment's tradition against monarchy and against unusual punishments like ear chopping restrain a president as well because of the oath.
Talking to Corey Bretschneider right now, professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the Constitution as it applies to the powers of a president and the limits of those powers? What constitutional questions do you think the president should have to consider before they take office? Do you think the Constitution goes far enough in providing a check on the executive branch? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the presidency and the U.S. Constitution. Our guest is Corey Bretschneider, author of The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. You can join in at 800-642-1234, whether you're a future president or not. What do you think a president should know about the Constitution before they take office? Do you think that the president should have to study that Constitution before they get into office? Do you think the modern American presidency is too powerful, not powerful enough? Do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Corey, a lot of your book is about the need to take the Constitution seriously for a president, but you also say, you know, it's not a sacred document in some ways. It was written by flawed people in some cases. There were flaws in the original Constitution. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, certainly the original Constitution, which preserved the slave trade, for one thing, for several years, they weren't even allowed to talk about it, and protected slavery, for instance, in the census counting enslaved people as less than a full person. Those were deep flaws. But what I say in the book is that over time, through amendments, partly the Equal Protection Clause that's been improved upon, and that also I don't think that the framers thought of themselves as perfect. They laid down some very broad provisions, including equal protection of law, no cruel and unusual punishment, due process, that open up a sense of values and a discussion for not just future presidents, future courts, future citizens, to consider the real meaning and to correct the framers when they were wrong. And certainly on the slavery issue, on segregation, they were deeply wrong. And so I'm critical in the book of views like Justice Scalia's, which have an overly narrow way of reading the text. Now, these sound like very abstract law school debates, but in the book, I just do it through stories. And I tell the story, for instance, of Joe Biden, a young senator at the time, confronting Justice Bork, an early defender of Scalia's view of constitutional interpretation, and really laying out this specific idea that, you know, it's a set of values that all of us have to engage in a conversation about. And that's part of what I'm trying to do in this very conversational style. It's somebody said it's like a dad leaning in to talk to his daughter. The book's dedicated to my daughter. And it's got that style to try to get us to reflect on not just the text, not just the cases, which I talk about and tell the stories of, but also the deep values of the Constitution.
Let's go to a caller now. Ray is with us in Eau Claire. Ray, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Ray?
Well, first of all, the speaker had some really good information, I thought. I read the Constitution again yesterday, and I was impressed with A, that's a relatively short document, B, that it leaves a certain amount of interpretation available, so if we need to make a change, we can. But I was concerned about the fact, I've been concerned over how little authority anyone has over the current president, and I see that that's right out of the Constitution, too. And I think it's John Adams, because he was trying to recreate Britain's system perfectly, and he did, including the king.
Yes, I mean, I take that up in the book, and I talk about the Adams tradition of thinking about presidents as in some ways beyond the other branches, maybe even above the law. Adams at one point considered bringing back royal titles, and he had a vision of the presidency that was much closer to monarchy. But my argument in the book is that we really, in the structure of the Constitution, reject that idea. The oath itself is about not profiting from office, serving the Constitution, the Emoluments Clause. And then I say in the book, controversially, that although there's a live debate, for instance, about whether a sitting president is immune from criminal indictment, for instance, in the Mueller investigation, that the framers disagreed. Hamilton thought, yes, a president was immune, but James Wilson of Pennsylvania said, the president is not above the law. And that's an idea that we see also in the Nixon case about U.S. v. Nixon, a unanimous case about the president's need to answer a subpoena. And the idea is very simple there. 8-0, a president is not above the law. And so I use that case, this history, to try to make the argument that actually even President Trump, any sitting president, is not above the law and actually can be subject to indictment. So I think the Constitution allows us to stop a president and to enforce the rule of law.
Ray, thanks for the call. Going out to Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hello, gentlemen. My question is regarding life. The Constitution must have some kind of way of determining when life begins. In other words, if you're born in the United States, does that mean your life begins at birth? You know, specifically with regarding the laws regarding abortion, and also with regard to eligibility for the presidency, only a natural-born citizen can become president. So how did, in 2018, how would life be defined as beginning, or when does life begin, and also what defines a natural-born citizen?
It's a great question. Roe versus Wade says the following thing. It not only provides a right of privacy that includes a woman's right to an abortion, but it also says that the fetus might be a person theologically. But as far as the Constitution is concerned, if a fetus was recognized as a person, that would mean that we couldn't have state-by-state decisions. We'd need a national ban on abortion. And the position of Roe, one of its most important holdings, is the idea that a fetus is not a constitutional person, and that's why there is a right to an abortion. Now, that's a complicated idea that justices like Gorsuch challenge. And one of the radical things about this justice, I think, as opposed to the one that I would choose, is that I think he actually is toying in his academic writing with the idea of a right of life of the fetus recognized by the court and nationally protected. So we're in a point of transition. We're arguing there are multiple interpretations of the Constitution. I don't hold Justice Gorsuch's view, but what you've asked, caller, really opens up the kind of dilemmas that I'm trying to look at seriously in this book.
Jeff, thanks for that call. We're talking to Corey Brettschneider. His new book is The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. The last portion of your book, Corey, is all about how to stop a president who doesn't follow those rules. So in 2018, looking back at the Constitution, what kind of tools are there to stop a president who doesn't honor these restrictions?
Controversially, I talk, as I said before, about the right of a prosecutor to indict a sitting president. Presidents like Clinton resisted that in Clinton v. Jones and in a series of memos. But I say, if you take seriously the idea that I started with, that Washington gave us, which is that the president is not the office, that there has to be a way of protecting the office from a president who goes astray. So indictment is one strong way that I argue for. Another less familiar way is, I go back to that Adams story. John Adams, as I said, signed the Alien Sedition Acts, making it a crime to criticize him. The sitting vice president, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison, the primary architect of our constitutional system, went back home to Virginia, and they passed two resolutions, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, that said, we're not going to cooperate with the federal government when it comes to unconstitutional policy. And my argument in the book is that cities like Santa Clara, and I profile the COO of Santa Clara County, Miguel Marquez, who are trying to use the 10th Amendment, the right of the states to resist unconstitutional executive orders, federal demands, that they are, while recognizing that the federal law is supreme, they're using the mechanisms of the states to say, we don't have to cooperate with ICE. Local police forces don't work for the president of the United States, and they can resist a president constitutionally when it comes to unconstitutional executive orders. So that's a second place, the role of the states. And the final, of course, is impeachment, the strongest remedy here. And there the hero is Frederick Douglass, I say, who said about the first President Johnson that when it comes to a openly racist president who repeatedly speaks against the basic rights of African Americans and who refuses to enforce the ban on slavery, let's just be honest and say this is why we're going to impeach him. Let's not have a legalistic argument about other matters. And I say, you know, that's really what impeachment is about. It's about the oath itself, a willingness to protect the Constitution, to respect the rule of law. And if it comes down to it, if there is a national debate about impeachment, we need to be honest about Frederick Douglass's recognition that this is a political process. There is no high crime in criminal law. This is a political standard that brings us right back to the title of the book, both the oath and the office. And I also take from a Republican member of Congress during the Nixon administration the following quote. He said, look, I'm voting for these articles of impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee because I want what we're doing now to be a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. And that Republican utterance at that time helped to bring down Nixon, and I use that in the book as the subtitle and also as a theme of the last chapter.
In our last minute or so, Corey, there were two, it seems like, overarching themes, the worry that a president would be a new king of England, or a worry that a demagogue would rise in the sort of the ancient Greek or Roman sense to motivate the masses to overthrow democracy. In our last minute, is the Constitution proof against that happening?
Donald Trump, I think, has created a stress test on the Constitution. It has many provisions which are honorable, including the oath itself, the First Amendment protection of free speech. But when you have a president repeatedly railing against those basic values, who, if he's read it, is hostile to it, for instance, in his attacks on the press, which is protected under our First Amendment, and his defense of the idea that the families of suspected terrorists should be tortured, violation, obviously, of our due process clause and our Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment, that is the kind of thing the framers were worried about. They had somebody like George Washington in mind who presided over the Constitution, somebody who had respect for the rule of law, respect for the citizenry. And, you know, yes, we are now faced with somebody who is exactly the opposite of that and what they feared. And this is a test on whether or not they prepared us for it. They gave us many mechanisms to resist such a person that I talked about. But will it hold? I don't know. That's, in the end, why I wrote the book. It's up to all of us to, in the next election, the midterms, and in the next presidential election, to defend the Constitution. Because,
and we'll leave it there. Thanks to Corey Brettschneider. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents.